Welcome to the changes to the Nemchin versus Green conference call. I would like to introduce Amelia Lecky. Please go ahead.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for joining us over your lunch hour. I'm going to give you a brief overview of the background of this case and what we're going to be covering today, and then Chad will jump in on some surveillance issues. In terms of the Nemchin and Green case, I think probably everyone on this call is aware that it's been winding its way through our court system over the last 7 years or so, and we have 11 reported decisions to date. It looks like we are finally at our last reported decision. Today we will be touching briefly on 5 of those 11 decisions, 3 dealing with social media and surveillance evidence, 1 dealing with assignments, and 1 dealing with costs and offers to settle and the impact of assignments on those. Just to give a little bit of context, the subject motor vehicle accident was December 2010, and the action was commenced just less than 2 years later. The trial lasted several weeks, included a jury, and the jury issued its verdict in April of 2017. The appeal was heard in December of 2018 with appeal reasons released in July of 2019, and then following the release of the appeal reasons, a number of issues went back to the trial judge for determination regarding cost of the action, the effect of assignments, and how that assignment would be implemented with respect to future collaterals. My co-presenter, Chad Letty, will speak to you first regarding the trial judges and Court of Appeal rulings on the use of surveillance evidence and social media evidence. Chad is a partner at Dutton Brock, a leading Toronto insurance defense firm. He has a diverse practice, including product liability, occupier's liability, construction, motor vehicle, and public transportation claims. I know because I have read and heard some of his speeches that he has spoken and written extensively on the uses and misuses of surveillance. He is also somewhat prone to giving rather long, complicated answers when asked on discovery if he will provide particulars of future surveillance as a result of his great knowledge in this area. So, Chad, I would turn it over to you.
Thanks, Amelia. I'm not sure about great knowledge, but certainly long-winded. So good afternoon, everyone. I'm here to discuss the surveillance side of Nemchin and Green and the implications on that side, and then obviously Amelia will be back to you talking about assignments and costs. So I'll just get right into what the motion decision at trial was with regard to surveillance. During a break in the plaintiff's examination in chief, counsel for the plaintiff, Ms. Nemchin, brought a motion seeking a ruling on whether all of the surveillance video that the defendant, Ms. Green, wanted to rely on as substantive evidence could be excluded. And I note here, because it will come up later, that the defendant's counsel had indicated that it was not their intention to rely on the surveillance evidence for the purposes of impeachment at that jury trial. They were only declaring their intention to rely on it for substantive evidence. So Amelia took you through some of the case history generally. I'll just point to a few things specifically relevant to surveillance. So at the examinations for discovery, there was no surveillance. A question was asked and answered to that effect. At no point after discoveries, but prior to trial, did plaintiff's counsel request an update on surveillance. There was an initial round done in May 2015, which was promptly disclosed in June 2015 via an updated unsworn supplemental affidavit of documents that listed the surveillance report and the video, both in Schedule A. And both the report and the edited video footage were provided to plaintiff's counsel at that time. There was a second round in September of that year, around the time of the pretrial, so September 2015. Again, surveillance was fully disclosed at that time, including the report and the video. A third round of surveillance was conducted in May 2016, but it was not disclosed until 2 weeks before trial, so it was not disclosed until January 30th, 2017. This is due to inadvertence, and there's no indication that the content of that report was different from either of the earlier reports, so there's nothing strategic about the non-disclosure. It happens. Of note, all of the reports indicated in the body of the report that the video accompanying the reports had been edited, but that unedited video existed and was in storage if anyone wanted it. On the Friday before trial, plaintiff's counsel requested production of complete and unedited video, and defense counsel promptly asked for that and obtained it and produced it within a matter of days while the trial was ongoing in its first week. So during the voir dire motion on the admissibility of surveillance evidence, the investigator was called who'd conducted the surveillance, and he gave oral evidence. And then defense's defendant's counsel relied on his testimony, relied on the reports, and he relied on both the edited and the unedited video to say that the surveillance met the test for admission as evidence, given that the investigator was there, he'd explained what he was doing. There was no evidence supporting any intention to mislead on his part. The edited and unedited video were substantially the same, and there was no evidence to support a finding that the videos themselves were inaccurate or that they were unfair in their representation of the facts. Defense counsel stated that the surveillance was relevant, even though it wasn't intended to be used for impeachment, but that it was relevant in light of the plaintiff's evidence at trial with respect to her functionality day-to-day being impaired by her psychological symptoms. So from what we can tell, the video included the plaintiff doing yoga, walking, meeting with friends, and bending over forward to pick something up, and driving. And it looks like the defendant would have wanted to include only a small portion of the 2-plus hours of total unedited video. I'll get that word eventually, the 2-plus hours of unedited video. And the defendant probably wanted to lead only a few minutes of that, probably four, perhaps double that in terms of the time. So there's nothing blockbuster on this surveillance. It was really going to be led in order to provide kind of a contextualization of the day-to-day functionality of the plaintiff, whose major complaints were psychological in nature. So interestingly enough, plaintiff's counsel had already conceded that the plaintiff had shown significant physical abilities, and in fact, in the examination in chief, plaintiff's counsel had shown video of the plaintiff doing yoga. This may have been a smart attempt to inoculate her from any adverse effects if the surveillance had gone in before the jury, which it ultimately wasn't allowed to. The plaintiff's theory at trial was that the plaintiff was dealing with psychological problems, principally PTSD. So in challenging the surveillance, plaintiff's counsel at trial took a run at the credibility of the investigator's work, saying there was contradictory evidence around timestamps, commentary in the reports, which again had been produced, were biased, which probably reflected bias while filming, and that the video stills included in the reports were again biased. And it was also noted that certain raw video had actually been deleted, and the unedited video, which was provided, was in fact lightly edited. And it looks like plaintiff's counsel, Mr. Obagi, who some of you may know as being very skilled in the use of technology at trial, conducted a pretty flawless technical takedown of the surveillance process, attacking gaps in the video, the selection of filming times, what looked like spliced together video, and he was able to slow those down and convince the trial judge that really there was a big problem with this video. The investigator didn't know what was going on, and one of the videographers who'd done the editing wasn't present to actually speak to that process. He also noted, plaintiff's counsel did, that surveillance had not been sent to any of the expert witnesses, which we'll come back to. So in making her decision, the trial judge stressed her role as a gatekeeper for surveillance evidence, and she used what she described as a three-part test to assess whether surveillance should be admitted. So she looked at whether or not the surveillance was accurate and truly representing the facts, and she used that to mean the sort of technical representation. So editing choices, as well as choices of when the investigator chose to turn the camera on and off. And here I have to say that it looks like the investigator had a bad day at trial. It appears he conceded parts of the video that showed the plaintiff were edited out. So it wasn't just a situation where, you know, when he was waiting for the plaintiff, he'd edited that out. In fact, some occasions where the plaintiff was seen were edited out, which must not have looked good. The trial judge also found that there were gaps in the video, which cumulatively meant that she was not confident that it was accurate or representative. The fact that the reports were produced appears to have been pretty damning for the attempt to introduce this surveillance. The trial judge found, when considering the second factor, the fairness or the absence of any intention to mislead with respect to the surveillance evidence, that the commentary was concerning, and it had led to conclusions the investigator misunderstood his role and was overzealous in his reporting. So what you're seeing there is almost a lens applied to private investigators as if they're supposed to be to some extent impartial. That's not expressly stated, but there's a concern there that I think everyone should have in terms of commentary that goes in reports, rendering those reports or the surveillance evidence more generally less admissible. With respect to the third factor, whether or not the surveillance could be verified on oath by a person capable of doing so, again, the trial judge noted the video editor wasn't there, and so that test hadn't been met. And in case she was wrong about the three-part threshold test, she went on to talk about the probative value of the evidence against its prejudicial effect. And she found the surveillance had little probative value, in that it showed what the plaintiff had effectively said she could do, and that there was some potential prejudicial effect as the experts had not had the chance to consider the importance of the surveillance. So she found that even if she was wrong on the three-part threshold test, it still shouldn't go in on the, under the normal evidentiary admissibility principles. She then declined to grant leave further under Rule 48.04, finding that the 3 weeks the plaintiff had the surveillance was not sufficient to address any prejudice, particularly the prejudice around getting their own experts to look at it. The adjournment was not reasonable. It's not reasonable to just insist that the plaintiff asked for an adjournment, and that the court should not reward noncompliance with disclosure obligations. So really, this is a three-part loss, unfortunately, on surveillance. And if this decision were to have been allowed to stand in its entirety as the leading case on surveillance, which it had been unfortunately feared might happen, we would have a much, much more restrictive surveillance regime for getting this kind of evidence in at trial. Fortunately, that appears not to have been the case, because the Court of Appeal has, while dismissing the appeal, has reversed a number of the rulings that were made within it. So I'll now turn to the Court of Appeal's decision. Justice Lowers for the court noted that surveillance may play a dual role, both for impeachment and to show the witness's true functionality as substantive evidence. Justice Lowers looked at whether the surveillance was inconsistent with the plaintiff's claims about her functionality, because she had testified that she had good days. Doesn't everyone say that? They have both good and bad days, I think. That's now required of all witnesses. But Justice Lowers noted that that didn't mean the surveillance became irrelevant. It was still relevant evidence on a critical issue, in this case the plaintiff's day-to-day living, and therefore it shouldn't be excluded. There shouldn't at least be a blanket exclusion. And to the extent that there were concerns about the nature of the impairment, the Court of Appeal felt that the jury's instructions could be crafted to prevent impermissible reasoning. Justice Lowers noted that there was a continuum between a flat-out discrepancy in surveillance and some small difference in functionality. Justice Lowers suggested that if there was a flat-out discrepancy, then the rule in Brown v. Dunn required that the defendant should put the surveillance to a plaintiff and ask them to explain the apparent inconsistency between what the surveillance showed and what the claimed abilities were. So coming back to the trial process here, I think what the Court of Appeal is telling us is that it's not necessarily the best case, and it may not even be permitted to only lead surveillance as substantive evidence, where you're effectively either saying or implying that there's a credibility issue due to an apparent inconsistency. You've got to give the plaintiff an opportunity to explain that, either explain it away or not explain it and fail in trying to do so. Okay, so a couple other points were, before we get further into the appeal decision, were just relevant on specific issues. So one was the timing of the motion to exclude. The Court of Appeal was quite insistent that really it ought to have been brought during the course of cross-examination, and it is generally premature to bring it before that. And there's a suggestion here that you may even want to have multiple different voir dires on different parts of surveillance, or I suppose social media evidence. But that just to say all of these several hours should be excluded, or all of them the defendant should have the right to let in, isn't really the way to go. There ought to be a more granular, discrete look at each individual either piece of evidence that's going to be put before the jury, or the bucket, I guess, of surveillance evidence. So the Court of Appeal looked at the trial decision and found that there were basically three substantive reasons that Justice Cawthorn had relied on to exclude the surveillance. The first was that the surveillance was not probative. The second was that it could not be assessed without having been shown to experts. And the third was that it was served too late. So the Court of Appeal concluded you couldn't really say that surveillance was not probative simply because it wasn't going to be used for impeachment. It could go in as substantive evidence even if there wasn't a requirement that it be presented to the plaintiff for the purposes of impeachment. The requirement, or the suggested requirement that the trial judge had made about surveillance being shown to experts was dismissed by the Court of Appeal, saying that in fact some of the plaintiff's evidence, such as the yoga video that the plaintiff had led, had not been provided to experts, and really left it at that. And then finally, the Court of Appeals said that the late disclosure was not fatal where surveillance was similar to earlier disclosed surveillance, none of which contained clear discrepancies. In other words, the focus here was on the surprise or ambush principles that the Court of Appeal has repeatedly come back to, including in Iannarella. Just said, look, the third block was similar to the two previous blocks that had been disclosed, and there's really nothing, you know, particularly breathtaking in that third round. And therefore, it wasn't unfair or it wasn't a surprise for it to have gone in late and still be admissible. Court of Appeal said that Justice Cawthorn in the trial ruling had also had a couple of process reasons for refusing to admit the evidence. These were the concerns about the unedited versus raw versus edited video, and about how the investigator not knowing how the editing was done. And the Court of Appeal really came back to the fact that doesn't affect whether or not a particular chunk of video accurately shows, you know, the plaintiff walking or driving or whatever. So the Court of Appeals sort of said, if you have someone there, not in so many words, who's taken the video and it accurately depicts what the plaintiff was doing, we don't need to get into a huge technical, seminar on video editing. I think they were of the view that that was enough. And the other interesting thing here was that the Justice Flowers had said the stills that were included in the body of the report, which may have been, you know, certainly partisan, and the commentary in the report was to some extent irrelevant. It's not as if the report would necessarily have gone to the jury. What was relevant was the evidence in the video itself. And again, coming back to the gaps, Justice Flowers felt it wasn't really meaningful whether or not whether there were gaps as long as the experts that were played were fair and accurate. So finally, it was ruled that the evidence in terms of the surveillance should have been allowed, but the appeal was still dismissed as the surveillance was said not to be so significant as to have affected the verdict. Okay, so I want to just go through a few takeaways. I think that's enough summarizing the cases. I think the first one is that we now have a bit of pushback from the Court of Appeal clarifying that the general principle is to allow surveillance in if it's relevant and it meets the normal admissibility criteria that predated the Nemchin trial decision. So it doesn't need to be, flawlessly edited, and you don't need to have three or four people there from the surveillance agency speaking to a chain of custody or anything like that. As long as it accurately depicts what the plaintiff is doing, that's enough on the technical side. Obviously, investigators may want to be careful about putting commentary that could be perceived as biased or partisan, and I'll circle back to that later. But the general principle that we have here is that the Court of Appeal is going back to the more broad principles that a defendant ought to be able to get this in if it's relevant and the jury could find it probative. Even if it's not a clear contradiction, if it could be probative, it should go in. So a couple other specific points here in terms of the admissibility standards. Does the surveillance need to be shown to experts? I think generally it does not, but it may depend. So if there's an orthopedic movement where the plaintiff is said to be doing something they've earlier claimed they're not capable of doing, you may wish to have an orthopedic surgeon look at that and see whether the movement is consistent or inconsistent, and the surgeon may wish to testify to that as well. But I'll just caution everyone, there is a case of Ahern versus Chang, a 2001 Superior Court case, that reminds us that disclosing surveillance material to a doctor or other expert results in a waiver of privilege over that material. So don't disclose video or a report and expect it to remain privileged. You may just want to send video only to an expert and leave out any commentary that would be included in a report. The second big takeaway is the use of surveillance at trial should really be broken up into discrete chunks. And particularly where you have different investigators, you may want to think about having a separate voir dire with each separate investigator who took surveillance footage. Similarly, the third big takeaway is that motions to exclude should also be as granular as possible. They should be done during cross-examination and with the benefit of the build-up to the inclusion of surveillance. And conversely, they should not be done during someone's examination in chief, which is interesting because obviously it would afford the plaintiff a different opportunity to explain away surveillance they knew was coming. Really, they have to get through their own examination in chief, and then later the court will determine whether or not surveillance should go in. So some of the final key issues I wanted to get through here are around the timing and content of disclosure. I know everyone's probably wondering, like, what can I do to maximize the chances my surveillance goes in, or alternatively, some of our friends from the plaintiff's bar who may be listening, What could I do to challenge it? So I'll just go through what I think the criteria now are. Iannarella and Corbett, back in 2015, saw the Court of Appeal make clear that Rule 30.07 requires that a defendant's affidavit be updated after an examination for discovery to list surveillance. The Court of Appeal has never said, though, that you need to produce a report, for instance. And they haven't even indicated that you necessarily need to produce the video if you intend to use the surveillance only for impeachment. So there are a couple sort of high-water cases from the Superior Court that say effectively that. There's the Arsenault and Armstrong versus Burke case, which Iannarella deals with but doesn't endorse on these points, which said that even if you do not intend to rely on surveillance for any purpose, you should provide particulars of the surveillance upon request. Well, I think it's right that Iannarella says you have to list the surveillance and you have to answer questions about particulars. So that's all well and good. However, Arsenault Armstrong also says that even if you do not wish to rely on surveillance for impeachment, you still need to be prepared to provide those particulars. So there's another case, Crom and Boumeister, that says the same thing. Even if you were to undertake never to rely on the surveillance, you still have to be prepared to provide particulars. So that's interesting. But Arsenault Armstrong goes a bit further and says that if you wish to rely on surveillance as substantive evidence, you must produce the report. And I think there's certainly a kernel in Nemchin and Green at the Court of Appeal that questions whether the report would really be necessary. If you're not relying on the report as evidence, and it's the video and the testimony of the investigator that will go to the jury, why should the report have any role, and why does it need to be produced? Certainly it opens the defendant up to more cross-examination, to have a full report that can be contrasted with video, because the investigator is probably inevitably going to summarize things in a way that could be subject to cross-examination. Okay, so to move on a little bit here, Rule 30.09 does say that where a claim of privilege is asserted over a document, a party may not use the document at trial except to impeach or with leave. So the rules themselves leave a little room for impeachment without having produced the video. The Court of Appeal's last commentary on this specific point was in Len Delfini versus Fargioni in 2006, where Justice Cronk stated that the provision of particulars is obligatory under the rules, even though the video itself need not be produced for inspection if it is to be used in the action only for impeachment purposes. So really, the question here is, do you need to produce the video if you intend only to use surveillance for impeachment purposes? The short answer is that's not entirely clear, but the safe answer is if you want to maximize the chances you're permitted to produce the video to the jury, you ought to have disclosed it to your colleague on the other side, ideally well in advance of the pretrial. And to come more specifically to the timing, I'll just note that the Rule 30.07 indicates that an affidavit must be updated forthwith. Really, the gold standard here is to produce surveillance to the other side, including either detailed particulars or just the video itself, after you receive it, and not, you know, a year later or a month before the pretrial. I know there's a couple other decisions on timing. In Belland and Hill, it said that an affidavit must be updated in a timely manner before trial, but then in Bishop Gittins versus Lim, Justice McKelvey declined to exclude surveillance wholesale, but said effectively he was disappointed in the way surveillance had been handled and that it should be disclosed promptly after each round of surveillance is undertaken. The final question I'll just touch on briefly, in this case isn't really germane to this, but it is an interesting question that people often ask about, which is, do you need to produce particulars of the surveillance you have prior to an examination for discovery? I think the short answer to that is now quite clearly no, you do not, if you're first to serve an affidavit of documents that's sworn. So I'll just go back to the originating case that's led to a lot of misunderstanding here, which is CC versus Bonk, a 1992 decision that said a party must provide particulars. It's sometimes misread to think it means particulars before the plaintiff's discovered, and it's relied on for that purpose, as is Iannarella. Neither case says that. There have been a couple of useful decisions recently, including Zdenko and Sutherland, a 2019 case where a plaintiff was permitted to examine the defendant before the defendant examined the plaintiff, because plaintiff had been first to serve a sworn affidavit. So in that case, the plaintiff was right to insist on getting a summary first. But then there's a consistent but different decision in Davis versus TTC, where Alexandra Valle for the TTC had gotten a ruling from Master Graham saying, no, in fact, in that case, she was first to serve a sworn affidavit, she could examine the plaintiff, having only disclosed the fact that she had surveillance in her affidavit, but without having given any particulars. So the useful thing to keep in mind, but that's a pre-discovery consideration, and this Nemchin and Green case is really about the use of surveillance at trial. So I'll be happy to take your questions at the end of the presentation. But with all that said, I want to pass things over to Amelia Lecky, who will be talking about costs and assignment and the other constellation of decisions coming out of this Nemchin and Green case. So Ms. Lecky is the Regional Senior Counsel for SGI in Ontario. Before moving to SGI late last year, she spent almost 20 years in private practice, with her focus being almost exclusively on insurance defense. And Amelia has developed a following on Twitter, at Amelia Lecky, due to her timely updates on case law impacting the insurance industry. And I certainly can't recommend her Twitter feed highly enough to you. It's how I've learned about a lot of new law in the past 6 months. So I'll pass it over to you, Amelia. Thank you.
Thanks, Chad. I think that's how we ended up doing this audio conference as well, because we found each other and decided we both want to talk about a case. So my update is a little less sexy than Chad's, bit more of the meat and potatoes in terms of dealing with assignments. But in this particular case at trial, the plaintiff was awarded $600,000 in loss of income. It was reduced somewhat because there was a finding of 10% contributory negligence, but there was still a significant future loss of income claim of over $500,000. No damages were sought for past loss of income, so it was pretty clear that everything was for the future. And about a year after the jury verdict, the defendant was successful in obtaining an assignment of the plaintiff's LTD benefits that she was receiving from Sun Life as of the date of trial. Obviously, the question of trust and assignments are dealt with under Section 267.8 of the Insurance Act. And the requirement for a plaintiff to hold such benefits in trust is only removed if the defendant is awarded an assignment. In obtaining the assignment, there were questions about how it would actually be done. Of course, this was obviously around the same time that we were dealing with silos versus apples and oranges and all those sorts of things. But the one thing that the trial judge said in 2018 when ordering the assignment is that the onus is on a defendant seeking the assignment to establish an entitlement to the assignment. They must provide persuasive evidence that is clear and beyond dispute that a plaintiff qualifies for the future benefits that are the subject of the assignment. Given the length of time that had passed, there was evidence at trial that the plaintiff was receiving long-term disability benefits from Sun Life. And what the trial judge indicated in the assignment decision back in 2018, that while the future loss of income award by the jury did not specify the number of years for which the award was meant to cover, that was not actually a requirement. Rather, that based on the trial evidence, the trial judge would have to make a finding as to the duration of any assignment based on the record. There was no question in terms of an issue of undercompensation in this particular case, according to the trial judge, because any assignment would only be in place for as long as the defense needed to have it to be reimbursed for the amount paid out. The trial judge noted the plaintiff had led no evidence of her ability to return to work, in fact, the opposite, and called an economic loss expert who testified and provided numbers for potential loss of income to age 65, 70, and 75. The defendant in this case only sought an assignment to age 65 because it was clear under the Sun Life LTD policy the benefits would end at that age in any event. So when the assignment was ordered, the numbers were obviously taken into account, and it was noted that the plaintiff would assign to the defendant all of her rights with respect to her LTD claim and benefits, and would also cooperate with the defendant to ensure that the assignment was put into place. The assignment, as I indicated before, was awarded in 2018, but of course was not put into place while the appeal was being considered. So after the release of the Ontario Court of Appeal decision in July of 2019, there were questions in terms of how the assignment would actually be put into place. And there were three main issues or disputes between the parties as to how that would happen. One was what impact the tax status of the LTD benefits would have. Two, was the effective date of the assignment the date of the jury verdict, or did it only come into effect once the trial judgment had been paid? And three, should the plaintiff be compensated for the cost she incurred to preserve her ongoing entitlement to LTD benefits? In terms of the tax status, there was no dispute that the plaintiff's benefits were taxable from Sun Life. Her employer had contributed some of the premiums. And the LTD carrier did advise that even if there was a court order requiring it to pay the LTD benefits monthly ongoing to the defendant, that did not relieve Sun Life of its requirement to reduce benefits and withhold taxes and other payroll deductions at source and remit them to the government. So the question became how that would come into play. The plaintiff wanted a credit for her gross monthly benefit, despite the fact that Sun Life couldn't pay the gross to the defendant. The defendant argued the plaintiff was only entitled to a credit for net benefits, as that's all they could possibly receive. By way of analogy, the trial judge looked at a case, 1966, from the Supreme Court of Canada, the Queen and Jennings, is available on Canley, that indicated the courts have been very reluctant to consider the impact of income tax on future care cost award, future income awards, because that deals with a lot of uncertainty and also impacts on the plaintiff's right to manage their income the way they want to. So, for example, someone may manage their money in a way that would allow for reduction of taxes, splitting of income and that sort of thing, and that really should be an issue that remains between the income tax payor and Revenue Canada and shouldn't be taken into account when assessing future income losses. By analogy, the trial judge therefore indicated that the withholding of taxes at source doesn't change the fact the plaintiff is entitled to the gross amount of her monthly LTD benefits. And if you refer to paragraphs 28 to 33 of the decision on the assignment, she went on to say that the taxation of LTD benefits were a matter between the plaintiff and Revenue Canada, and the defendant was therefore entitled to a credit for the full amount of LTD benefits available. In terms of actually implementing how that would work, the trial judge suggested two different options, and she used round numbers in order for the math to be easy. So, for example, using hypothetical numbers, if the future loss of income was $100,000, and the annual gross amount of LTD benefits was $10,000 with $1,000 withholding, there were two ways that the assignment could be implemented. First of all, the LTD carrier could pay the defendant $9,000, and the plaintiff could top up that amount by $1,000, allowing for the $10,000 assignment per year. The plaintiff would obviously have available to her the monies paid out for the future loss of income claim to do that top out, and the assignment would last 10 years. Alternatively, the LTD carrier could pay the defendant $9,000 a year and extend the assignment for a little over 11 years to make up for the difference paid per year. The trial judge was concerned that the second option could potentially prejudice the defendant because it would extend the time of the assignment and maybe mean they didn't get a full credit for the full amount paid, and therefore ordered that the option one of the payment directly by the LTD carrier and the top-up of the plaintiff would be the way that the assignment would be implemented, subject to any agreement between the parties otherwise. The trial judge noted that the first option in terms of how the assignment would be put into place would result in consistency between cases regardless of whether the LTD benefits are taxable or not, and would also provide the shortest period during which an assignment would be in place, therefore limiting the need of interaction between plaintiff and defendant in that regard, and would also keep the plaintiff's actual tax arrangements private as they would be irrelevant to the calculation of the amount paid on the assignment. It would also eliminate the potential for double recovery of the plaintiff. In terms of the second issue, the effective date of the assignment, the defendant not surprisingly wanted the assignment to be effective as of the date of the jury verdict. The plaintiff was of the view that until the judgment was paid in full, that the assignment would not be triggered. In reviewing the reasoning of the Court of Appeal in a case of Carroll, C-A-R-R-O-L-L, in McEwen, a 2018 Court of Appeal case, the trial judge held that the effective date of the assignment would be the date of the decision or verdict at trial. The purposes of the assignment the trial judge reviewed indicated that it was in part to prevent double recovery, and further, to obtain an assignment, a defendant is required to bring a post-trial motion using the facts of the case in Nemchin and Green. That obviously took a year, which potentially would eat into a year of the assignment. In the Carroll case, the verdict was in October of 2015, and the assignment motion wasn't heard until March of 2016. In that case, obviously, there was a seven-month delay between verdict and the actual assignment being awarded. The trial judge was of the view that ensuring the effective date is always the date of the trial decision or the jury verdict provides certainty and reduces the need for procedural motions on that particular issue. She also commented that on, for example, if a verdict is issued when a plaintiff is 64 years old and it takes a year to get the assignment in place, that could potentially remove the entire value of the assignment. While an assignment is not triggered until the judgment is paid, that doesn't equate to changing the effective date of the assignment. The plaintiff was therefore ordered to disclose the value of her LTD benefits that she'd received from the date of the verdict and ongoing, but the case is silent on whether the defendant would be entitled to a direct credit for the benefits received from verdict till date of payment of the judgment, or whether it would basically be an exchange of checks, i.e. the full judgment is paid and then there's reimbursement. In terms of the cost of preserving the rights to LTD benefits, there was evidence that the plaintiff took steps following the verdict to preserve her right of ongoing LTD benefits, including applying for pension benefits and working with Sun Life with regards to the requirement for various medical assessments. In fact, the defendant in Nemchin and Green did not take issue with the reimbursement of that amount. The amount of the costs agreed to aren't referenced in the decision. In terms of the trial costs, they were issued in a separate decision a day later from the assignment decision, and there were a number of issues that were not in dispute. There was no dispute in terms of entitlement to cost, disbursements, docketed time, partial indemnity rates for most timekeepers. There was a small dispute with respect to the partial indemnity rate for senior counsel. Not entirely sure why it was such a dispute, but since it ultimately reflected a difference of less than $3,000 in the overall cost award, but there is some comment that is rather interesting. Starting just a year before trial, counsel would have been in the 20-plus year category for indemnity rates, partial indemnity rates. And there was a question of whether he should be assessed a rate that was sort of at the beginning of that inflation-adjusted maximum rate. The inflation-adjusted maximum rate for 10 to 20 years experience at that time was about 366, whereas the inflation-adjusted maximum rate for a lawyer with 20 years of experience was about 426. And there is a comment by the trial judge that, well, plaintiff's counsel at time of trial was in his 22nd year of practice, and therefore in the lower range of 20 years plus. He had extensive experience beyond the average of a civil litigator with his number of years at the bar, and therefore the proposed rate of 375 was reasonable. The bigger issue in terms of the dispute for trial costs was whether costs should be considered with regards to gross or net damages awarded, and what impact, if any, the assignment of future LTD benefits would have on the assessment of costs. After taking into account the collateral benefit deduction, the plaintiff recovered just under $160,000 for general damages, past care costs, prejudgment interest, and future care costs. The defendants had made an offer of $160,000 inclusive of damages and prejudgment interest plus partial indemnity costs. The offer made by the defendants didn't make any mention of damages for loss of future income or the plaintiff's potential entitlement for future LTD benefits. The defendant argued the plaintiff should have anticipated that if she was awarded damages for future loss of income, the defendant would be successful in obtaining an assignment of future LTD benefits. It was the defendant's position that the cost assessment should be based on the net recovery of just under $160,000 at trial, but the trial judge did not agree. She indicated that there was no certainty the plaintiff would be continued to be entitled to LTD benefits at the time of the offer, and it would be unfair to fix the cost of the action on the basis of an assumption that she would remain entitled to benefits, LTD benefits, until the assignment was exhausted. Put another way, there was no evidence put forward to suggest that the entire $540,000 awarded in future loss would be reduced to zero as the result of an assignment. In addition, the plaintiff had claimed damages of just under $1 million. After a 10% reduction for contributory negligence, gross damages awarded at trial were close to $700,000. As such, the amount recovered was reasonably in keeping with the amount claimed, and the plaintiff should be awarded her costs as such. Partial indemnity costs were awarded of just over $350,000, which was about half of the gross damages awarded the plaintiff by the jury. Once HST and disbursements were taken into account, total cost award was just over $465,000. So that was rather a quick and dirty in terms of the assignment and the cost. Does anybody have any questions either for Chad or for myself with respect to the surveillance, the assignments, the costs, or any of the other issues we've touched on?
And perhaps I can just ask the moderator to just jump in and remind everyone how they can put a question in the queue.
Yeah, just to remind everyone, if you want to ask a question, please press 01.
Okay, and while we're, I guess, waiting for hands to go up, so to speak, I just have a kind of pre-canned question here for Amelia. So, Amelia, one interesting implication of this assignment decision, one of them, is that this case related to LTD benefits, but what impact do you think there may be with respect to assignments for other types of benefits, which obviously can be very significant if you're talking about attendant care or med rehab benefits in catastrophic cases on the statutory accident benefits side, for those of us in Ontario?
There was another decision released by the same judge on the same day from another decision, also with Mr. Obagi as plaintiff's counsel, Rowley and McDonald, R-O-L-L-Y. And in that case, Mr. Rowley was awarded damages of $2 million at trial, including future care such as occupational therapy, special glasses, vision therapy, attendant care, etc. And while there wasn't a dispute by the plaintiff in that case as to the defendant's right of an assignment, there was a dispute again as to the effective date. Again, the trial judge said it was the date of the jury verdict. And therefore, the defendant was entitled to a credit of payment for all SAB's benefits that had been received from the date of the verdict to the date of the assignment, and the date, in fact, that the judgment was going to be paid. Who was required to disclose the amount of all the SAB's benefits he received or would receive from the date of the verdict to the date of the payment of judgment. That case does address a little bit more specifically the question of how the assignment would be applied. So again, not necessarily apples to apples, but it does focus on the need for a defendant to ensure that there is some evidence to make sure that the assignment can be classified into the silos that have been talked about by the Court of Appeals. So just something to keep in mind in terms of making sure the damages are quantified. I think what I've been struggling with in terms of the assignments and how you take them into account is, at least with IRBs or long-term disability, those are ongoing benefits which, once you apply for them, you're probably going to keep getting them. Where I think it's a little bit more difficult is if, in fact, someone has been receiving $3,000 of attendant care and you get the deduction up to the date of trial and the assignment up to the date of the payment of judgment, I don't see any obligation on the plaintiff to continue making those claims. So both of the assignment orders talked about a requirement of the plaintiff to, you know, participate in disputes, mediations, etc. But no one specifically seems to have indicated that someone's required to keep getting attendant care or required to keep getting an OT to provide them with care. So that's where I kind of wonder how much use this is actually going to be to us.
Right.
I had one question, unless there's a question in line. Actually, I had a question for you, Chad, too.
Sure, yeah.
Well, we do have one question in the queue. Right. It's up to you if you want to take it now or...
No.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so first question comes from Christina Cook from PKS Lawyers. Please go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks so much for the presentation. This question is for Chad. It notes that the trial judge appears to have dealt with both the surveillance and the social media posts in the same way. Did the Court of Appeal treat them as the same type of evidence? Was there any substantive differences in regards to tendering either surveillance and video as opposed to social media posts?
Hi, yeah, thanks for the question. I think there's not a principal distinction between the two categories of evidence that the Court of Appeal got to in this case, which sort of makes sense. I mean, in a way, both types of evidence ought to be known to the plaintiff. Like, if I'm posting something on social media or if I'm, you know, digging a ditch, those are both things that would be known to me, notwithstanding whether or not the defendant saw me doing either of those things. So there wasn't any kind of principal difference articulated, but there was a pretty big factual distinction here in terms of, like, how the evidence was collected by the defendant. Effectively, the plaintiff had allowed the defendant to access their social media account, which the defendant did, pursuant to an agreement. So it wasn't just like they, you know, kind of busted the plaintiff here and found a secret, what do the kids call them, the Finstagram account or something like that. But in more seriousness, they had an agreement, but then the defense appears to have just, you know, through inadvertence, not necessarily fully disclosed what they had collected from that Facebook account. That's one of the factual issues. But there was also an issue around, like, there was just no copy of the posts that were retained as part of the trial record. So there were some kind of complicating factors on the social media information here. So that's part of why I didn't get into it. And the other part is that it's also a fairly big area on its own. So just some time constraints. But there was like confusion, the trial judge said, around the origin of the social media posts and how the disclosure had occurred. And so here the trial judge said they ought not to be admitted. And, you know, I think the Court of Appeal just was wary of disrupting that, not having perhaps enough evidence to make a reasoned ruling on it, as there were some things that were missing from the record that was before the Court of Appeal. So I wouldn't look to this case as any kind of precedent on the social media side. It's just a bit messier than on the surveillance side.
Great, thank you.
All right, next question comes from Christine Demelin from ADS Forensics. Please go ahead.
Hi. Thank you again for the conference. And I just had a question regarding the assignment of the future collateral benefits. More so in thinking about the plaintiff whose benefits are taxable versus an individual who has non-taxable benefits. And the argument that I was looking at that might come up, that the plaintiff whose benefits are taxable is now prejudiced by this decision and the assignment of benefits. Just in thinking about the example that was set out in the decision where a benefit carrier would seek an assignment for the net because they have a responsibility to remit taxes on an LTD benefit. And then the plaintiff would have to top up that benefit, but then also would be stuck with a potential tax liability on the gross amount of that benefits when they go and file their tax return at the end of the year and are now required to pay income taxes on that benefit to CRA.
Thank you for the question. So what the court basically said is ultimately one of their goals in terms of dealing with the assignment this way is allowing the tax relationship between the plaintiff and the tax authority to remain private. So they can go and do whatever they want. You know, the flip side would be a plaintiff who's really good at tax planning and they in fact get money back. Does that mean that they would then have to remit that if they're really good at tax planning? So the focus on this case was A, trying to come up with consistency. So whether you are getting $10,000 a year in benefits tax-free or whether you're getting $10,000 in benefits and part of that is being remitted on your behalf, you are going to be responsible at the end of the year for making sure that the assignment results in the defendant getting the gross amount. And the idea, just working through the numbers from the two options that the judge gave, is, you know, if someone gets $100,000 in future loss of income, they get a check for $100,000 from the defendant, then they need to make sure that that assignment is managed. They're getting $10,000 a year gross in LTD. $9,000 is going to be paid by their LTD carrier. They have to top it up by $1,000 out of that $100,000 that they've already received. So then they can go and deal with their tax status any way that they want, and they don't have to tell the defendants about that. So that really there would be consistency and hopefully the less need for procedural motions resulting in costs and all those sorts of things. And one other thing I would mention on that is that the loss of income benefits that you're awarded at trial are awarded on a gross basis. They're not, they don't have taxes withheld or whatever. So, I mean, it probably would be a good idea if you're in this situation to go and get some accounting advice in terms of how you structure this. And what Sun Life did say in terms of the assignment is they couldn't get out of their remittance requirements. That's just not something they could do. So it was just not something that they could do a workaround for. So even if the plaintiff is able to, you know, reduce their taxes completely and show it to Sun Life is still required to deduct and remit at source. So it would just create a bit of an administrative nightmare trying to deal with it too.
Yeah, I do recall seeing that and agreeing with that. I just wondered if the decision is more to the advantage of if you have a plaintiff who has non-taxable benefits that they now win to a higher degree than a person who has taxable long-term disability benefits.
Well, if they're getting $10,000 gross a year, they're either not getting that $10,000 and it's being paid directly to the defendant, or they're having the tax remitted and they may get a refund, right? So that's what the judge was sort of saying, is it would be a lot of work to figure out what goes on, right? This way, they can go in, they can do their taxes, and if they have a way where they can reduce their tax burden, maybe taking some of the loss of income and doing RSP contributions or something like that, that's up to them. And they can manage their tax burden in any way they want without the need to have that disclosure to the defendant. And if they do that and they get all the tax back, then they can use their tax refund to pay their top up for next year, right? But that's getting into accounting, and I'm only a lawyer.
Okay, well, I thank you for your insight.
No problem.
All right, and that was the last question we currently had in the queue.
Okay, well, drawing up close to an hour, but Amelia, I'm cognizant of the fact that you were about to ask me something and then I jumped to our caller. So if you want to still ask me that one, you go ahead. Otherwise, we could wait a moment and see if there are any other questions.
So was this the thought I had as you were talking? Do you think there's actually any substantive difference or any significant difference between the use of surveillance as substantive evidence versus impeachment now?
Yes, I think so. I think that you're going to, based on this Court of Appeal direction, you're going to get into trouble if you attempt to rely exclusively on the use of surveillance as substantive evidence in many cases. I sort of struggle to think of too many cases where you would have surveillance that you're not suggesting contradicts the plaintiff's evidence to at least some extent. And so where that's the case, I think the Justice Lowers' implied direction here is that you should at least offer the plaintiff an opportunity to explain to some extent, like, the more obvious contradictions or implied contradictions between what you're showing them doing for an hour on video and what they say they can do. It was interesting, though, that Justice Lowers also noted that you can use surveillance for both. And I think maybe the point here is you've got to give the plaintiff an opportunity to explain the contradiction, but that could be brief. And then you can do more contextualizing and more of just presenting the jury with a day in the life of this plaintiff who appears relatively normal or appears however they appear. You could do that at more length on the substantive side. But I think this case is starting to indicate that, you know, you really ought to be putting it to the plaintiff if it's worth putting in. And then there is this remaining distinction between the disclosure obligations on impeachment evidence and substantive evidence, and that used to be a much broader gap. Like, it used to be that if you had it and you were holding it only for impeachment evidence, you didn't even have to update your Schedule B, and you could effectively ambush the plaintiff. You know, there was that proviso in the rules saying if you didn't necessarily need to update Schedule B documents, and that had been relied on by, like, Justice Quinn in the McDonald decision to say you didn't even need to update that at all. Iannarella wiped that out, and so now you need to be providing an update promptly whenever you get surveillance, but the question is what you do after you've provided an updated affidavit. And I think this case is saying that you should, again, you should be providing that fairly promptly, and you should be providing particulars if asked. But the more interesting little point here buried in the Court of Appeal decision is, I think the Court of Appeal ruled that the third round of surveillance could go in only because it was the same as the two previous rounds. Yeah. And so if you have something that's blockbuster surveillance, you really should think carefully about providing the video, even if you intend to only use it as impeachment. Because there probably will come a day where a court will say, you've only listed this in an updated affidavit. The plaintiff's lawyer never, by happenstance, asked you for particulars, and now you're using this blockbuster evidence to totally destroy a plaintiff's case. Well, that's, in a way, that's not fair, and it violates the sort of surprise and fairness obligations that are principles that are articulated by Iannarella. And so that hasn't come up yet, but I think there will be a day where surveillance is probably rejected for impeachment purposes just because there wasn't enough proactive, voluntary disclosure, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your perspective.
Makes sense. All right. There are no other questions. I think we can let you guys go on to your continuing on with your day.
Okay, well, thanks again to everyone who dialed in, and thank you to CDL for allowing us to give this presentation and for all its work updating all of us on legal developments and building our community across the country. I noticed we had a few callers from other jurisdictions, so hopefully they found this valuable as well.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes the Namchin versus Green conference call. Thank you for your participation, and have a nice day.